This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, this is Gary Clinton, and you're listening to episode number 50 of Night Transmissions. Up first tonight, we have an episode of The Secrets of Scotland Yard. The Secrets of Scotland Yard was a production of the Towers of London syndication, a company started and owned by Alan Towers. At the time, the BBC had a stranglehold on radio production in Britain, so Towers had to figure out a way to get around these strictures, and he did this by making syndication deals with other companies throughout the world. There is a really interesting history of machinations on the part of Towers and his associates in getting this program on the air. I won't go into it here. That's not really the purpose of the show. But if you're interested, drop by the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, and go to the show notes for this show. Again, this is show 50. And you'll find a link to a good-sized, but not overwhelmingly large, article on Alan Towns' efforts. It's very interesting reading. Now, because of the eccentric way that this program was produced, no one's really quite sure when it was made. But the best guess is that it was probably produced in 1947.
How do you do? This is Clive Brooker. You remember the story of the little boy who was carrying an even smaller boy up a hill? Someone stopped him and asked whether the burden was not too much for him. "This isn't a burden," he replied. "It's my brother." That was the sort of reply that Patrick Staunton might have given had anyone ever asked whether the weight of his brother's responsibilities was not sometimes too heavy for him to bear. The love that Patrick Staunton bore his younger brother Louis was something quite out of the ordinary, and it involved them both in a case that was also quite out of the ordinary. I want to tell you about it today. Few people can find anything good to say about a murderer. And yet most criminals have some virtue. It's just that it can't be seen for surrounding vices. For instance, there was a charm about Neville Heath. There was gentleness in Dr. Crippen. There was a sense of humor in Charlie Peace. There was a great deal of brotherly love in Patrick and Louis Staunton. It was the one quality which was constant in their approach to any person or any problem. It remained constant throughout their dealings in one of the most horrifying cases of the last century, the case of the brothers Staunton. It all happened in Kent around the year 1876. Yes, the lovely old village of Cuddam in Kent was for a short time spotlighted in the blaze of publicity surrounding the two brothers who lived there. Now, although Patrick Staunton was 2 years older than his brother Louis, he had nothing but admiration for him, while Louis, in his turn, regarded his older brother with something very near to hero worship. Both extremely good-looking lads, they'd been inseparable throughout their school days. The fact that Patrick became an artist, while Louis preferred the life of an auctioneer's clerk, did nothing to separate these two. Nor did their bonds of affection slacken in the slightest when Patrick, now 26, decided to get married to a girl named Elizabeth Rhodes.
You know, Louis, I've always thought that one of the nicest things about my going around with Elizabeth was that you were going around with her sister.
Yes, Patrick, we make a good foursome. Two brothers in love with two sisters. I'll never be able to thank you enough for introducing me to Alice. You are in love with her, aren't you? Well, I certainly like her a great deal. I wouldn't say that I was head over heels in love, as you are with Liz. Then I haven't such a fiery temperament, have I? Otherwise, I might have been a painter as well.
Louis, I'm going to marry Liz.
Pat, why didn't you say so immediately? Congratulations, my dear old boy. Where is she? This is something to celebrate.
Now, just a minute, eh? There's something I'd like to talk to you about first.
I know what it is. This house, eh? Well, of course, you must have it, Pat. There certainly isn't room here for the three of us. I tell you what, Pat. What do you think of this for an idea? I'll go and live in Cherry Cottage. Then I'll only be 100 yards away from you.
That's a grand idea. Wait a bit, though. We've got enough money. They're asking quite a lot for it, you know.
Well, we have between us. Well, do lend me a bit just for the time being.
I need you ask. Of course I will.
Now, what about this celebration?
Emily, it wasn't about the house I want to speak to you. You see, I was thinking about you and Alice.
Well, what about us, old man?
Well, I'm marrying Liz, and I was hoping that you might want to marry her sister. I mean, we four get on so well together, don't we?
I know what you mean, Pat. It would be a grand arrangement. But at present, I have other ideas about a wife.
Well, I rather felt that Alice was expecting a proposal for you any day now.
Look here, Pat, old man. Alice would be the last woman in the world to marry me in my present financial position. She made it quite plain to me that the only way I can hope to keep her with me is to earn, or acquire, enough money to make her very comfortable.
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. I suppose that means you have to wait some time.
I'm not so sure. I've been working on the problem, and I hope that within a fortnight, I'll be able to announce to you my engagement.
You don't quite follow all this. You just said that Alice...
Forget Alice. The name of the young lady I hope to make Mrs. Staunton is Harriet.
What? Not Harriet Richardson.
The very same. 22 years of age, good background,
plain as a pudding.
Agreed. As plain as a pudding. But a very rich pudding. She has £4,000 in the bank.
I see. Are you in love with her?
Madly.
And if she hadn't any money?
Who knows? Perhaps I wouldn't have noticed her charms.
I always think you turn into a first-rate scoundrel.
Well, no one knows me better than you do, Pat.
Patrick Staunton's wedding went ahead without a hitch, but young Louis's engagement did not go quite so smoothly. The young lady in question, Harriet Richardson, was indeed extremely plain, nor did she make up for her physical deficiencies with any outstanding mental qualities. No one knew this better than her mother, Mrs. Richardson, and she was naturally suspicious when the dashing young Louis Staunton came to ask her for her daughter's hand.
I find it rather difficult to believe, Mr. Staunton, that after such a short acquaintance with my daughter, that you should be so infatuated.
Your daughter, madam, is to my mind the most desirable of companions. I am happy to think that she returns my affection.
Oh, yes. I know Harriet is madly in love with you. But then, frankly, there have not been many young men who have paid her the attention that you have.
I cannot for the life of me think why not, Mrs. Richardson.
Come now, Mr. Staunton. Let us come out into the open. We are both aware that Harriet is, well, not pretty.
Physical attraction has never meant very much to me, ma'am.
I wouldn't say that Harriet was particularly bright, either.
There I would venture to disagree.
In fact, the only real attraction she would seem to offer a good-looking young man such as yourself is her money.
Money, Mrs. Richardson?
You didn't know about her money, I suppose.
I believe Harriet did mention a small amount in the bank, but I hope you're not suggesting...
I am suggesting, Mr. Staunton. And I warn you that I shall do everything in my power to stop you marrying my daughter. Just because I realize her defects doesn't mean that I don't love her, you know. Her welfare is the most important thing in the world to me. If and when she marries, I want her husband to be someone who will love her for her many excellent qualities, not for her bank account. Good day, Mr. Staunton.
But in spite of all Mrs. Richardson's efforts to prevent it, the marriage between Harriet and Louis eventually took place. The bride's mother did not attend. So now the two brothers were both married. And although Louis no longer lived in Patrick's house, he was not far away, and the two couples saw much of each other. It was about 6 months after Louis's wedding that he took to coming to his brother's house almost every evening without Harriet. And it wasn't entirely coincidence that his former sweetheart, Alice Rhodes, was staying with her sister, Mrs. Patrick Staunton.
Ah, come in, Louis. We're expecting you. Harriet, not with you?
No, I left her at the cottage. Phew, it must be all of 6 inches of snow on the ground.
Now, go in by the fire. I'll hang your coat up. There's someone inside who'll be glad to see you.
It's the best part of the day when I can come over here and see you all.
Listen, I don't fool ourselves, but it's us you come to visit. Does Harriet know about you and Alice?
Well, I've told her that I knew her before I married.
What are you doing out there, Pat? Bring Louis in here by the fire. He must be frozen.
Coming, my dear.
Good evening, Liz.
Hello, Alice.
Hello, Louis.
Come over here by the fire, Louis. Unless you'd like to sit there with Alice.
Yes, thanks. I think I'll sit here.
Harriet stayed back at the cottage, I suppose.
Yes, she had a bit of a headache. She wanted to be left alone, and to tell you the truth, I was quite happy to leave her. She's rather trying when she's not well.
Poor Louis. I shouldn't think she's the most considerate of wives.
I wish I'd never married her.
You didn't exactly hope for companionship from her, did you, Louis?
Of course I didn't. I never realized she'd be as maddening as this.
Poor Louis. You should have married me, after all.
I think we ought to leave these two together, don't you, Pat?
Yes, perhaps it would be a good idea. I want to turn in early. Anyway, see you tomorrow, Louis.
Look, I don't want to disturb you like
this. Nonsense! You haven't much chance of seeing Alice nowadays, and I know she'd like a good talk with you. Good night, both of you. Tell me, dear.
Right, Emma, dear.
I'm glad they've left us alone, Louis.
Alice, I wish we could be together more often. It's so stupid. All I married Harriet for was the money that could make you happy, and now we can't be together to share it. Oh, I nearly forgot. I bought this for you. It's a gold watch.
Oh, Louis, you darling. Oh, what a beautiful thing it is. With my name on the back as well. Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Alice, I'm going over to Bromley tomorrow for the day. Harriet won't be coming. Will you come with me?
Louis, I'd love to. Will you buy me some clothes?
I'll buy you whatever you want. What else is money for?
There were many little expeditions to Brumley and other places in the weeks to come. Alice Rhodes' name came to be linked with that of Louis Staunton whenever the village gossips met. And inevitably the rumours came to the ears of Mrs. Richardson, who didn't know where her daughter was and naturally was extremely worried. You see, Harriet had made it clear when she left her mother that she never wished to see her again, and for months there had been no word of the girl. But now, hearing of the behaviour of her son-in-law, Mrs. Richardson made a personal visit to his brother Patrick, whom she knew to be living in the village of Currum. She was not, however, prepared for the reception that Patrick gave her.
Yes?
Mr. Patrick Staunton?
That's right. What is it you want, please? I'm out in the middle of a painting. I don't like being disturbed.
I wanted to have a talk with you about your brother, who is married to my youngest daughter, Harriet.
Oh. You are Mrs. Richardson?
Yes. Could you tell me something about them? I've had no word for over 7 months. I don't even know where they live.
And why should you want to know about them after the way you treated them at the time of the marriage?
Perhaps I was a bit hasty. Nevertheless, I'm very concerned
yes,
about Harriet.
Very concerned indeed. When all you've done is to try to cause her misery. Let me tell you, madam, that your daughter has made a very good marriage. My brother Louis has made her far happier than she was from living at your home. And while I stand up, you'll not be allowed to come between them again.
You're being most insolent, Mr. Staunton. I have just assured you that I am anxious only for Harriet's welfare. Surely you can't refuse her mother her address.
I surely can, madam. I surely do. Goodbye.
But Mrs. Richardson was not to be put off so easily. Thoroughly concerned about her daughter, she renewed her inquiries in the village of Currum and finally discovered that Harriet and Louis were living in Cherry Cottage, not 100 yards from the house she had just visited. To Cherry Cottage she went without delay, only to find, when the door opened to her knock, that Patrick Staunton had preceded her. This time he was even more offensive than before and threatened her with bodily harm if she ever dared to interfere again. Mrs. Richardson, now convinced that some serious mischief was afoot, went to the police.
And so, officer, I came straight to you. I'm sure something is going on in that house, and that whatever it is harming my daughter.
What is it you think may have happened, Mrs. Richmond?
Richardson is the name. I don't know what is going on, As I told you, Mr. Patrick Staunton refused to let me either enter his house or his brother's. Why should he do that unless he wanted to hide something from me?
Tell me, madam, did you get on very well with your son-in-law?
Louis Staunton? No, I did not.
Hmm. And I think you said your daughter wrote that she did not want to see you anymore.
Yes, she did. But that was some time ago.
Richardson. Wouldn't you say that in the circumstances it would be quite natural for them to refuse you admittance to their house?
Officer, Inspector, whatever you are, my instinct is never wrong about these things. And I know instinctively that my daughter is in trouble.
Well, the best I can do then, madam, is to promise to keep an eye on the Staunton family and let you know should anything come up that's out of the usual.
Yes, but...
I'm sorry, but that's all I can do. And now, if you'll excuse me...
If I'd ever known the police in this village were so inefficient, I should never have bothered you. Good day.
Good day, Mrs.
Richardson.
Unfortunately, village police are so used to dealing with village gossips that when a sincere person such as Mrs. Richardson comes along with a rather unlikely story, they're apt to treat her and her accusations with skepticism. It will surprise both the police and Mrs. Richardson to know that at the moment when this unsuccessful interview was taking place, Harriet Staunton was a prisoner, a starving prisoner in Cherry Cottage. Staunton could not have hoped to hide forever from his wife the relationship between him and Alice Rhodes. In any case, Miss Rhodes was not as careful as she might have been. The more money Louis spent on her, the more her love for him grew. If she was away from the neighborhood for more than a few hours, she would send him long and passionate letters, fervently reminding him of her adoration. Though absence parts us for a while and distance rolls between, believe whoever may revile, I'm still what I have been. It was thus that she ended one of her letters, the one that Harriet Staunton discovered. Harriet had a turbulent scene with her husband. Now, Louis Staunton did not like scenes. He wanted life to be easy, and at the moment it was far too noisy and complicated. With great confidence, he went to see his brother Patrick.
Pat, it's all got a bit too much. I can't stand the rows that are going on. Can't you suggest any way in which I can be free to see Alice whenever I want to? There's only one way I can suggest, Louis. Leave Harriet. But it's her money that keeps Alice to me, Pat. If I left Harriet, I'd be broke. I can't think of a way out. Harriet won't even allow Alice inside the house now. Louis, why not let Harriet come over and stay with us? It couldn't then be said that you were leaving her. She's always complaining about lack of company, so she ought to be pleased to stay with us for a while. Pat, it's a grand idea. I'm sure we could make her come. Then I'd have more freedom.
That's right, and you could come over quite often.
But you wouldn't like her here, Pat. She can be the most maddening person. I don't think you'll be able to stand her for long.
No, I think we can manage her, Louis. Anyway, the important thing is for you to be happy. You know, I'd do anything in the world to bring that about.
It's grand of you, Pat. But I insist on paying for her keep, though.
No nonsense. I wouldn't dream of such a thing.
But of course. Look, I'll pay you £1 a week to keep her as a lodger.
All right, if you insist. £1 it is.
So Patrick took in his brother's wife as a lodger for £1 a week. This curious arrangement did not work very well. For one thing, Harriet was continually trying to leave the house to go in search of her husband. Now, Patrick didn't want his brother worried, so he had to keep doors and windows locked in whatever room Harriet was using at the moment. But still, she made a nuisance of herself. Like so many painters, Patrick found it quite impossible to work without complete silence around him. And while Harriet was in the house, he seemed destined to have only noise.
Liz, what can I do? It's quite impossible to paint with that screaming din going on. Isn't there any way we can have some peace?
I told you that's crazy to have her in the place. Why don't you send her back to Louis? She's his wife, let him take care of her.
I can't do that. Louis has as much right to be happy as anyone.
Really, Pat? You're so soft about that brother of yours.
No, Liz. Don't say anything you might regret.
All right. Let's do something about Harriet. What about the attic? I could shove a mattress up there.
No, she'd just go on screaming. I've thrashed her 3 times today and still she goes on.
We'll put her in the attic anyway. There's no way of escape from there. So at least we won't have to look around locking the doors and windows all day. And I will think of a way to keep her quiet. She must be pretty strong to bang and shout like that all the time. Perhaps her lungs wouldn't be quite so lusty if she had her food cut down.
Not only was Harriet's food cut down, it was cut off altogether. She was kept in a filthy room in the attic with very little air. It was not long before her strength failed completely. She was obviously very near death. None of the local doctors had seen Harriet, and Patrick was worried lest a death certificate should be hard to come by. The last thing he wanted was an inquest. Of course, there would have to be a funeral, but naturally he didn't want Mrs. Richardson to hear about that. In view of all these circumstances, it seemed eminently desirable that Harriet Staunton should die somewhere else than in Patrick's house. But where? It was finally decided that Penge should be the locality. Penge, a little town on the borderlines of the counties of Sussex and Kent. Louis and his sister-in-law, Liz, went to explore the locality. They found what they thought were ideal lodgings and paved the way for Harriet by having a chat with the landlady, a Mrs. Quist.
You see, Mrs. Quist, this lady is not a very healthy person.
Oh, bless you. I've taken care of invalids before.
I'm glad to hear it. Harriet is indeed an invalid. As relations, we feel very anxious to do all in our power to make her last days as comfortable as possible.
And you see, Mrs. Quist, the doctor that's been looking after her hasn't got our full confidence. We've heard that there are some good doctors here in Penge who will know how to treat a paralysis case.
Oh, bless you, yes. We have some wonderful doctors here. We'll take care of the poor lady for you.
I'm afraid she hasn't long for this world. Oh, and there's one other thing. Her illness sometimes makes her delirious. She says things against the very people who love her most. I thought I ought to warn you, so that you wouldn't pay any attention.
Oh, the poor soul. Don't worry, sir. I'll take good care of her.
And so Harriet was moved to the lodging house in Penge. Even the landlady, prepared as she had been by Louis' description of the patient, was shocked at Harriet's appearance. Her body was alive with vermin, and her skin resembled more the bark of a tree than human flesh. Patrick Staunton called in a local doctor on the same evening that Harriet came to Penge, but the case was hopeless. Harriet died within 24 hours. It seemed to Patrick and Louis that the burden of this woman's life was now lifted forever from their shoulders. Actually, Harriet Staunton was to prove far more troublesome dead than alive.
Where are you taking me now, Pat? I've come across a bit of a difficulty, Louis. We must make some inquiries. Well, what's the trouble? The fool of a doctor has given us a certificate. Did you read what he put on it? He says Harriet died from cerebral disease and apoplexy. Sounds terrible, doesn't it?
The certificate's all right. It's just what we wanted. But it has to be handed into a registrar.
Well, isn't there any register in Penge?
That's the trouble. There are two. I don't know which to go to.
Well, let's toss a coin for it.
No, you don't understand, Louis. You see, the lodging house where Harriet died was almost exactly on the borderline between Sussex and Kent. There are two registers in Penge. One for the Sussex side and the other for the Kent side. Now we have to find out which one to go to. I thought we'd ask at the chemist over there.
Well, that's no difficulty. Nothing wrong in asking a question.
Here we are, then.
Do you want to go on the road?
There's someone in there at the moment. We'd better wait until he comes out.
Nonsense, what are you so nervous about? There's no harm in what we're going to ask. Come on.
Good evening, sir. Lovely day, isn't it? What can I do for you?
This other gentleman was before us. Doesn't he want to be served first?
No, it's quite all right. This gentleman's waiting for a prescription to be made up.
Oh, I see. Well, I wanted to ask you about the handling of a death certificate. I don't quite know which register to go to. The lady was staying practically on the borderline of the counties.
I see. Well, it should be quite simple. Was she a resident in Penge?
No, she only came recently from home, in Cobham, Kent.
Well, then, I'm pretty sure the right registrar for you will be Mr. Bain.
Who knows? Perhaps if the village of Cobham had not been mentioned by Louis, no trouble would have occurred. But by one of those coincidences that would outrage the reader of a novel, but of which life is full, the customer waiting in the chemist shop happened to know someone who lived in Cobham. In fact, his sister-in-law, Harriet Staunton. Yes, this gentleman had married Mrs. Richardson's elder daughter, and he knew all about the trouble with the Thorntons. His mother-in-law had often expressed her fears for Harriet. And when he heard the name, he pricked up his ears. He went further. He got the name of the doctor who had given the death certificate and went to see him. As a result of his interference, the thing the Thorntons feared most was brought about. There was an inquest. The inspector in charge of investigations, Inspector Thomas, was not quite sure of his ground. He talked it over with his superior.
You see, sir, the doctors haven't found any organic disease sufficient to account for death. There was a small tubercular deposit in one lung, but they say it was of no importance. We've got an expert from London down here, and he states there is no trace of poison in any of the organs. And yet I'm still convinced that she was murdered.
But how do you think it was done, Thomas?
Well, that's just what I don't know, sir. I've never seen a body so emaciated as hers was. If it didn't sound so incredible, I'd say she'd been starved to death. But the maid at Mr. Patrick Staunton's house, where the deceased lived before coming to Penge,
says that she was treated as an honored guest.
Did you search the house?
No, sir, I didn't think it was necessary.
Might be worthwhile, Thomas. Have a look at the room she was using. She might have left some diary or letters behind and try to find some people in Cadham who saw Harriet Stunton before she was brought to Penge. They might have noticed something of the ordinary.
Righto, sir. Thank you very much.
Inspector Thomas didn't find any diary or letters. The Saunders had made quite sure that all Harriet's belongings were burnt. But what he did see made such documents unnecessary. One glance at the attic room in which Harriet had starved made it quite clear that whatever her position in the family, she had not been treated as an honored guest. A filthy mattress lay on the floor. The window was boarded up and the door had been fitted with a bolt on the outside. These facts carried great weight with the jury at the inquest, and a verdict of willful murder was returned against Patrick and Elizabeth Staunton, Louise Staunton and Alice Rhodes, two brothers and two sisters. Such was the popular feeling in the district that the trial was moved to London. It took place at the Old Bailey in September 1877. The defending counsel, Mr. Edward Clark, presented his case in a very unemotional manner.
Members of the jury, I want you to divorce from your minds for the present any feelings of indignation that the prosecution might have inspired in you. For the task on which I am about to embark is, I say it myself, an extremely difficult and extremely technical one. The defense is that Harriet Staunton died from tubercular meningitis. Now, members of the jury, you've probably never heard of this disease. Indeed, it is one almost unknown to the ordinary member even of the medical profession. But I am going to attempt to present all the known facts about it to you. For I am certain that the death of Harriet Staunton was due not to poison, not to starvation, but to this relatively unknown disease. Now, first of all, I would like to make a few general observations.
Mr. Edward Clark's speech to the jury was long, technical, and brilliant. It was generally thought that had he been alone with the jury, he'd have succeeded in convincing them. But the judge, Sir Henry Hawkins, gave one of the most deadly summings up ever known in the Old Bailey. Indeed, his speech might better have come from the lips of the prosecuting counsel, and its effects were inevitable. All four prisoners were sentenced to death. It was then that the letters began to pour into the Home Secretary's office.
Signed by 700 medical experts, with Sir William Jenner at their head, to the effect that the facts as stated at the post-mortem point clearly to death having been caused by several...
I'm glad to know this morning that you are to reopen the case of the Staunton's. I feel sure that when this proves up that we have...
The result of the new inquiry was that the sentences of Louis and Patrick Staunton and Patrick's wife Elizabeth were commuted to penal servitude for life, while Alice Rhodes, who stood to profit most from Harriet's murder, was granted a free pardon and immediately released. It seems that from the purely legal point of view, the paying of £1 a week to Patrick and his wife for the care of Harriet placed them under a special obligation to prevent her from starving. Consequently, their guilt was, in the eyes of the law, greater than Louis's or his young lady. And so... the case of the two inseparable brothers came to an end. Callous, yes. Brutal and ruthless, yes. But there remains their outstanding love for each other. Patrick and Louis, who, when the sentence of death was being passed on them, forgot their womenfolk entirely and clasped each other's hands for mutual encouragement, thinking only of the great love which ironically made their savage crime possible. I'll be back again soon to tell you some more of the secrets of Scotland Yard. Meanwhile, this is Clive Brooks saying goodbye and pleasant dreams.
Want a job that pays great, no pressure? Then become a United States Post Office employee. If you've been following the news, you know that right now the Post Office is a little worried about upsetting their employees. That means you'll sail right through your job interview.
Well, that's about all, Mr. Zuni. You got any hobbies?
Cleaning my guns.
And do you have any...
Stop asking so many questions!
Okay, you're hired.
And once you're on the job, it gets even better.
Hey, Zuni, you've been on this coffee break for almost an hour. Can't you see I'm under a lot of pressure? Leave me alone!
Okay, okay. Take another hour. Get the job that puts you in charge. Remember, guns don't kill, postal workers do. A message from the NPWRA, the National Postal Workers Rifle Association.
Well, this brings us to our first break. Hey, I'm sorry, but I gotta do it. But I'm just gonna play some music, okay? This next show is from the Black Mass for October the 20th of 1969. Yes, Tree.
Welcome to the Black Mass. Everyone who has traveled over eastern England knows the smaller country houses with which it is studded. The rather dank buildings, usually in the Italian style, surrounded with parks of some 80 to 100 acres. I have to tell you of a curious series of events which happened in such a house. It is Castringham Hall in Suffolk. I think a good deal has been done to the building since the period of my story. One feature that marked out the house from a score of others is gone. As you looked at it from the park, you saw on the right a great old ash tree, growing within half a dozen yards of the wall and almost or quite touching the building with its branches. I suppose it had stood there ever since Castringham ceased to be a fortified place. At any rate, it had well nigh attained its full dimensions in the year 1690. In that year, the district in which the house is situated was the scene of a number of witch trials. Castringham contributed a victim to the extortions. Mrs. Mothersoul was her name, and she differed from the ordinary run of village witches only in being rather better off and in a more influential position. Efforts were made to save her by several reputable farmers of the parish, but what seems to have been fatal to the woman was the evidence of the then proprietor of Castringham Hall, Sir Matthew Fell.
Sir Matthew, will you tell the court, please, what you saw regarding Mrs. Mothersoul on the evenings that you mentioned?
Well, on three different occasions from my window, I watched her, Mrs. Mothersoul, at the full of the moon, gathering sprigs from the ash tree near my house. She had climbed into the branches and was cutting off small twigs with a peculiarly curved knife. And as she did so, she seemed to be talking to herself. On each occasion, I did my best to capture the woman, but she had always taken alarm at some accidental noise I had made. All I could see when I got down to the garden was a hare running across the path in the direction of the village. And on the third night, I followed her at what speed I could. Now, I went straight to Mrs. Mothersoul's house. I had to wait a quarter of an hour battering at her door, and when she came out, she was very cross and apparently very sleepy, as if just out of bed. And as I had no good explanation to offer, I had to apologize, rather embarrassingly.
Mainly on this evidence, though there was much more of a less striking and unusual kind from other parishioners, Mrs. Mothersoul was found guilty, and condemned to die. She was hanged a week after the trial with 5 or 6 more unhappy creatures. The other victims were apathetic or broken down with misery. But Mrs. Mothersoul was, as in life so in death, of a very different temper.
Oh, her poisonous rage did so work upon the bystanders, yea, even upon the hangman, that it was constantly affirmed of all that saw her that she presented the very living aspect of a mad devil.
Yet she offered no resistance to the officers of the law. Only she looked upon those that laid hands upon her with so direful and venomous an aspect.
Aye, the mere thought of it preyed inwardly upon my mind for 6 months after.
However, all that Mrs. Mothersoul is reported to have said were seemingly meaningless words.
There will be guests at the hall. There will be guests at Castringham Hall, Sir Matthew. There will be guests at the hall.
Sir Matthew Fell, then deputy sheriff, was present at the execution and was not unimpressed at the bearing of the woman. He shared certain misgivings over the whole business with the vicar of his parish as they rode from the scene of the gallows.
I'll say it again, Mr. Crome. My evidence at the trial was not given willingly. I'm not at all specially infected with the witch-finding mania, but I declare that I could not give any other account of the matter than what I had given. And I could not possibly have been mistaken in what I saw. But the whole transaction has been repugnant to me. Now, I am a man who likes to be on pleasant terms with those about me. Yes, those are my sentiments, Mr. Crome.
And the good vicar applauded them, as any reasonable man would have done, and was easily persuaded to take a late supper at the hall. When Mr. Crome thought of starting for home about 9:30, Sir Matthew and he took a turn on the graveled walk at the back of the house. They were in sight of the ash tree, which I described as growing near the windows of the building, when Sir Matthew stopped.
Mr. Crome, look there a moment.
Where, Sir Matthew?
At the ash tree there. Look, what is that runs up and down the trunk of it? It is never a squirrel. They will all be in their nests by now.
Ah, yes, I see some sort of moving creature.
What can you make of it, Mr. Crome?
Nothing of its color in this moonlight, Sir Matthew. But now it's gone.
Was it a squirrel?
Well, for an instant there was a sharp outline. And I could swear, though it sounds foolish, that squirrel or not, it had more than 4 legs. Aye, more than 4 legs, Sir Matthew.
Next day, Sir Matthew Fell was not downstairs at 6 in the morning, as was his custom, nor at 7, nor yet at 8. Hereupon, the servants went and knocked at his chamber door. When the door was at last opened from the outside, they found their master dead and black. Mr. Crome came as quickly as he could to the hall and was shown to the room where the dead man lay. Many years later, Mr. Crome's notes regarding this incident were found among his papers. They showed how genuine a respect and sorrow he felt for Sir Matthew. And they also threw some light upon the common beliefs of the time.
There was not any the least trace of an entrance having been forced to the chamber. But the casement stood open, as my poor friend would always have it in this season. He had his evening drink of small ale in a silver vessel of about a pint measure, and tonight had not drunk it out. This drink was examined by the physician from Bury, Mr. Hodgkins,
who could not, however, as he afterward declared upon his oath before the coroner's quest, discover that any matter of a venomous kind was present in it. For, as was natural in the great swelling and blackness of the corpse, there was talk made among the neighbors of poison. The body was very much disordered as it lay in the bed, being twisted after so extreme a sort as gave too probable a conjecture that my worthy friend and patron had expired in great pain and agony. And what is as yet unexplained, and to myself the argument of some horrid and artful design in the perpetrators of this barbarous murder, was this, that the women which were entrusted with the laying out of the corpse and washing it, being both sad persons and very well respected in their mournful profession, came to me in great pain and distress, both of mind and body, saying what was indeed confirmed upon the first view.
We had no sooner touched the breast of the corpse with our naked hands than we felt a violent smart and aching in our palms.
Aye, and the swelling, oh, the swelling from the palms to the elbows, so immoderately. The pain still continuing that for many weeks afterwards we were forced to lay by the exercise of our calling.
And yet no mark to be seen on the skin. No mark seen on the skin.
Upon hearing this, I sent for the physician, and we made as careful a proof as we were able, by the help of a small magnifying lens, of the condition of the skin on this part of the body. But we could not detect any matter of importance beyond a couple of small punctures or pricks, which we then concluded were the spots by which the poison might be introduced, remembering that ring of Pope Borgia, with other known specimens of the horrid art of the Italian poisoners of the last age. So much is to be said of the symptoms seen on the corpse. As to what I am to add, it is merely my own experiment, and to be left to posterity to judge whether there be anything of value therein. There was on the table by the bedside a Bible of the small size in which my friend used nightly and upon his first rising to read a set portion. And I taking it up, not without a tear duly paid to him, it came into my thoughts to make trial of that old and by many accounted superstitious practice of drawing the swords. I must needs admit that by my trial not much assistance was afforded me. Yet, as the cause and origin of these dreadful events may hereafter be searched out, I set down the results. In the case, it may be found that they pointed the true quarter of the mischief to a quicker intelligence than my own. I made then three trials, opening the book and placing my finger upon certain words, which gave in the first these words from St. Luke, chapter 13, verse 7.
Cut it down. Cut it down.
And in the second, Isaiah, chapter 13, verse 20.
It shall never be inhabited. It shall never be inhabited.
And upon the third experiment, Job, chapter 39, verse 30.
Our young ones also suck up blood. Our young ones also suck up blood.
Thank you.
This is all that need be quoted from Mr. Crome's paper. Sir Matthew Fell was duly coffined and laid into the earth. His son, Sir Matthew II, succeeded to the title and estates. It is to be mentioned, though the fact is not surprising, that the new baronet did not occupy the room in which his father had died. Nor, indeed, was it slept in by anyone but an occasional visitor during the whole of his occupation. He died in 1735, and I do not find that anything particular marked his reign, save a curiously constant mortality among his cattle and livestock in general, which showed a tendency to increase as time went on. The second Sir Matthew was duly succeeded by his son, Sir Richard. It was in his time that the great family pew was built out on the north side of the parish church. So large were the squire's ideas that several of the graves on that unhallowed side of the building had to be disturbed to satisfy his requirements. Among them was that of Mrs. Mothersole. A certain amount of interest was excited in the village when it was known that the famous witch, still remembered by a few, was to be exhumed. And the feeling of surprise and indeed disquiet was very strong when it was found that though her coffin was fairly sound and unbroken, there was no trace whatever inside of it of body, bones, or dust. One morning, it was in 1754, Sir Richard woke after a night of discomfort.
Mrs. Chiddock, I can certainly not sleep in that room again.
Oh, sir?
The chimney smoked persistently, yet it was so cold that the fire had to be kept up. Furthermore, something had so rattled about the window in the wind that no man could get a moment's peace. No, I'll certainly not sleep in that room again, Mrs. Chiddock. I shall select a new room this morning.
As you say, sir. There's the fine large study across the hall, if I may suggest.
No. No, it has an eastern aspect. I must have a room with a western lookout so that the sun does not wake me early. And the room must be out of the way. I don't want servants forever passing the door.
Well, Sir Richard, you know there is but one room like that in the house.
Oh? Which may that be?
Why, sir, that is Sir Matthew's room, the west chamber.
Well, put me in there. I lie there tonight.
But no one has slept there these 40 years. The air has hardly been changed since Sir Matthew died there.
Well, then, it's time the air be changed. Come along, Mrs. Chiddock, I'll see the chamber at least.
So it was opened, and indeed the smell was very close and earthy. Sir Richard crossed to the window, threw the shutters back, and flung open the casement. The view was almost entirely blocked off by the ash tree.
Oh, sir, the tree. It makes the room so oppressive, so dampish, sir.
Well, we'll shortly take care of that. Air the room, Mrs. Chiddock, all today, and move my bed furniture in the afternoon. When the Bishop of Kilmore arrives, you can put him in my old room.
But, sir, there's a fearfulness about this room. It's the very room...
Yes, yes, it is here my grandfather died. Make no difficulties about it, Mrs. Chiddock. I do not wish to listen to any more. Be about the airing. Be about the airing.
In the afternoon, the Bishop of Kilmore arrived. He had risked the approaching storm in order to have an hour with Sir Richard before the arrival of the other guests. The bishop had brought with them a manuscript, come upon while exploring the papers and other remains of the once vicar of Castringham. And for the first time, Sir Richard was confronted with the enigmatical Sortes Biblicae of Mr. Crome, which you have already heard. They amused him a great deal.
Well, my grandfather's Bible gave one prudent piece of advice, cut it down. If that stands for the ash tree, may rest assured I shall not neglect it. Such a nest of catarrhs and agues was never seen.
I was wondering, sir, your parlor here contains the family books.
Ah, yes, I wonder whether the old prophet is there yet. Now, let's see. The Bibles are kept over here. And I know the one... A thick, dumpy... Ah, yes, here it is. Look here. Look here. Sure enough, the inscriptions. The inscriptions on the flyleaf. To Matthew Fell. From his loving godmother, Anne Aldis. The 2nd of September, 1659. Well, well, your lordship, it would be no bad plan to test them again, eh? I'll wager we'll get several family names from the chronicles. Let's see now. See, what do we have here?
Thou shalt seek me in the morning, and I shall not be. Thou shalt seek me in the morning, and I shall not be.
Later came the other guests. Dinner at 5, wine, cards, supper, and dispersal to bed. Next morning, Sir Richard is disinclined to take his gun with the rest. He talks instead with the Bishop of Kilmore. As the two are walking along the terrace and talking over certain alterations and improvements for the house, the Bishop suddenly pointed to the window of the west room.
You could never get one of my Irish flock to occupy that room, Sir Richard.
Ah? Why is that, my lord? It is, in fact, my own room.
Well, our Irish peasantry will always have it that it brings the worst of luck to sleep near an ash tree. And your fine growth of ash is not 2 yards from your chamber window. Perhaps it has given you a touch of its quality already. You do not seem, if I may say it, so much the fresher for your night's rest as your friends would like to see you.
Yes, that though something else, it has true cost me my sleep from 12 to 4, my lord. But the tree is to come down tomorrow, so I shall not hear much more from it.
Ah, I applaud your determination. It can hardly be wholesome to have the air you breathe strained, as it were, through all that leafage.
Your lordship is right there, I think. But I had not my window open last night. It was rather the noise that went on, no doubt from the twigs sweeping the glass that kept me open-eyed.
Oh, I think that can hardly be, Sir Richard. Here, you can see from this point, none of those nearest branches can touch your casement. Unless there were a gale, and there was none of that last night. They missed the panes by a foot. No such truth. What then will it be, I wonder, that scratched and rustled so? Aye, and cover the dust on my sill with lines and marks. Ah, well, sir, might it be the rats that must have come up through the ivy?
Of course, the rats. It was the rats.
So the day passed quietly, and night came, and the party dispersed to their rooms, and wished Sir Richard a better night. And now we are in his bedroom, with the light out and the squire in bed. The night outside is still and warm, so the window stands open. There is very little light about the bedstead, but there is a strange movement there. It seems as if Sir Richard were moving his head, rapidly, to and fro, with only the slightest possible sound. And now you would guess, so deceptive is the half-darkness, that he had several heads, round and brownish, which move back and forward, even as low as his chest. It is a horrible illusion. Is it nothing more? Ah, there. Something drops off the bed with a soft plump, like a kitten, and is out of the window in a flash. Another. 4 of them. And after that, there is quiet again.
Thou shalt seek me in the morning, and I shall not be. Thou shalt seek me in the morning, and I shall not be.
As with Sir Matthew, so with Sir Richard, dead and black in his bed.
pale and silent party of guests and servants gathered under the window when the news was known. Ominous guesses were hazarded. Italian poisoners, Popish emissaries, infected the air. But the Bishop of Kilmore looked up at the ash tree. He noticed that a white tomcat was crouching in the lower boughs, looking down the hollow which years had gnawed in the trunk. It was watching something inside the tree with great interest. Suddenly it got up and craned over the hole. Oh, well now, Kitty, what do you see there inside the ash? Careful. Careful of the edge there. Careful now. But the bit of edge on which it stood gave way, and the cat went slithering in. Everyone looked up at the noise of the fall. It is known to most of us that a cat can cry, but few of us have heard, I hope, such a yell as came out of the trunk of the great ash. Two or three screams there were, and then the slight and muffled noise of some commotion or struggling was all that came. But Lady Mary Harvey fainted outright, and the housekeeper stopped her ears and fled till she fell on the terrace. The Bishop of Kilmore and Sir William Kentfield stayed.
There is something more than we know of in that tree, my lord. I'm for an instant search.
I agree with you there, Sir William. We must get to the bottom of this. The secret of these terrible deaths is there, in the ash tree.
A ladder was brought, and one of the gardeners went up, and looking down the hollow could detect nothing but a few dim indications of something moving. They got a lantern, and the gardener let it down by a rope cautiously. They saw the yellow light upon his face as he bent over, and suddenly the face became struck with an incredulous terror and loathing.
Oh!
He fell back from the ladder, letting the lantern fall inside the tree.
Quick, Sir William, catch the man. What has he seen? What has he seen?
He's in a dead faint, my lord. It will be some time, I fear, before any word can be got from him. But look to the tree. Look to the tree, my lord. It's aflame.
The bystanders made a ring at some yards' distance, and Sir William and the bishop sent men to get what weapons and tools they could, for clearly whatever might be using the tree as its lair would be forced out by the fire.
And so it was. First, at the fork, we saw a round body, covered with fire the size of a man's head, appear very suddenly. Then seemed to collapse and fall back. This five or six times. Then a smaller ball leapt into the air and fell on the grass, where after a moment it lay still. We went as near as we dared to it. And saw.
Look, your lordship. It's an enormous spider. The remains, veinous and seared, of an enormous spider.
And as the fire burned, more terrible bodies like that began to break out from the trunk. And it was seen that these were covered with grayish hair.
There will be guests at the hall. There will be guests at Castringham Hall, Sir Matthew. There will be guests.
All that day the ash burned, and until it fell to pieces the men stood about it and from time to time killed the brutes as they darted out. At last there was a long interval when none appeared, and we cautiously moved in and examined the roots of the tree. We found below it a rounded, hollow place in the earth, wherein were two or three bodies of these creatures that had been plainly smothered by the smoke. And
What is to me more curious? Now, at the side of this den, against the wall, was crouching the anatomy or skeleton of a human being, with the skin dried upon the bones, having some remains of black hair. It was pronounced by those that later examined it to be undoubtedly the body of a woman, and clearly dead for a period of 50 years.
Okay, we got a little bit of a break here. Be right back. That was the Black Mass's adaptation of The Ash Tree, produced in December of 1963. Black Mass was a small but reasonably good quality program that never found a real syndicator and was heard, as far as I know, in only two cities. The first being Berkeley, California, where it was produced sporadically. Between 1963 and 1970, producing only, well, nobody really knows exactly for sure, but 31 episodes survive. Oh, the other city that it was heard in was Los Angeles, California. As usual, there's a bit more detail on this story in the show notes on the web at www.nighttransmissions.com. And by the way, if you want to read the original story, it's in the public domain. And so, if you go to the show notes and look around a little bit, you'll find a link to download it.
My complexion's so bad, I hate to go out.
Don't be a square. Try Ting, the faster way to clear up pimples.
Yes, doctors' half-face tests prove Ting medicated cream dries up pimples more effectively than any other product tested. Here's why. Boys and girls have overactive oil glands. Excess oil clogs pores, causes pimples. But Ting blots up oil faster, more completely than other products. In lab tests, Ting completely absorbed oil in 15 minutes. Hours later, other products still had not. No, hiding pimples won't help heal them. No mere cover-up can work like Ting's antiseptic medication. Remember, doctors' half-face tests prove Ting better in every case, better than any other remedy tested. Applied at bedtime, greaseless, stainless Ting dries to oil-absorbing powder that clings all night, even helps heal acne-type blemishes. Don't let externally caused pimples spoil your fun. Get Ting Medicated Cream, T-I-N-G.
Now, it's time for science fiction. I'll bet you didn't know that Jack Benny ever did science fiction. Well, I sure didn't. I knew he did television. I knew he did radio. I know he did movies. I know he did vaudeville. I know he did legitimate theater. I know he played a mouse. No, he really did. This is Cartoon, The House That Jack Built, which is a parody of the old Jack Benny show, and stars Jack and Mary Livingston and Rochester. Pretty much the whole gang is there. I found that this cartoon's available on the web at YouTube, so in the show notes I provided a link to the cartoon. Check it out. It's really kind of fun. In the meantime, here's Jack Benny and Plan X. This episode of Suspense aired on February 2nd, 1953.
And its 98,000 dealers bring you Mr. Jack Benny in tonight's presentation of Suspense. Tonight, Tonight, Autolite, following a popular trend, anticipates the strange disappearance of experimental rocket ship Y-272B. The time, the year 2053. The place, the planet Mars. The star, Mr. Jack Benny. Say, Hap, that was quite a speech you made last night. You were as dynamic as an Autolite stay-full battery.
Oh, that's flattery, Harlow.
And what a battery it is, Hap. The Autolite stay-full is the power-packed pepster that needs water only 3 times a year in normal car use.
I really don't deserve such praise, Harlow.
Why not? That's the battery with the fiberglass retaining mats protecting every positive plate to reduce shedding and flaking and give the Autolite stay-full longer life, as proved by tests conducted according to accepted life cycle standards.
That was really good, eh, Harlow?
Oh, no one could do any better than to visit his nearest Autolite battery dealer, who services all makes of batteries. To quickly locate him, just call Western Union by number
and ask for operator 25. I'll tell you the name of your nearest Autolite battery dealer where you can get an Autolite stay full.
The battery that needs water only 3 times a year in normal car use. And remember, from bumper to taillight, you're always right with Autolite. And now, Autolite presents transcribed Plan X, starring Mr. Jack Benny, hoping once again to keep you in suspense.
The card. Do you have the card yet?
One more run through the machine.
Touareg, when do you think the Earth rocket is arriving?
Tomorrow. But if the Grand Council wanted the card before now, they should have asked me before now.
Is that it? Let me see it.
Mm, here.
13756. Zeno. Assembly line worker. Atomic escalator factory.
Mm.
Touareg, this is the man for the job?
He has the specifications called for.
An assembly line worker. That's incredible. Incredible.
Yes? Yes, right away. You may go in now, Zeno. The Grand Council is ready for you.
One, 13756 called Zeno. Come forward.
Yes, sir.
Zeno, the Grand Council of Mars has a mission for you to perform.
Me? A mission?
You have been selected because of the qualities shown on your work and identity card, Form 42-A. Set habit patterns, attention to detail, no strong emotional or biological drives, and complete suppression of imagination.
Well, I always pride myself
that I... Do not speak unless questioned, Zeno. The Grand Council has other important matters of state.
Oh, of course, of course.
You have heard the telepathone broadcast that an armed rocket from the planet Earth is approaching Mars.
Hmm? Oh, I did hear something about it, yes.
Their course has been plotted as bringing them to a landing on the plane outside the city at 10:14 tomorrow morning.
10:14. You know, I wouldn't mind seeing that.
You will see it, Citizen Zeno.
Me?
You.
Well, I'd certainly like to, but I'm due in the atomic escalator factory at 8. I'm on stair treads, you know. And
we've arranged a leave from your job.
Leave? Well, I'm not arguing with the Grand Council, but I've got a pretty important job there, and...
13756, you've been selected to meet and deal with the Earth rocket.
Me?
You will put Plan X into operation.
Plan X?
Citizen Zeno, every Martian for the last 50 years has been thoroughly grounded in Plan X, if and when a rocket should come from the Earth.
Oh. Oh, Plan X. Oh, you see, I thought you said Plan X. Of course.
Then you understand and accept the responsibility.
Oh, anything to help out.
Those assisting you on the mission will be in contact with you.
Good, good.
Have the other council members any questions?
No, I don't believe so.
13756 called Xeno. You are now officially operating under the provisions of Plan X.
Well, thank you. I took the aerial transmission belt directly home. Let them get along without me at the escalator factory if they could. Besides, it was almost quitting time. I went to bed early that night. Tomorrow was going to be a big day. Plan X. Out of the whole population of Mars, I was picked to carry out Plan X. Oh, I'll admit I had my criticisms of the Grand Council in the past, but this restored my confidence in them. Yes, sir. They couldn't have picked a better Martian. I think I'll have a second cup of Ostrich, Mother.
Zeno, you haven't time. You'll be late for the factory as it is.
As I told you, Mother, I'm on leave. Orders of the Grand Council.
Oh, yes, of course. Plan X. But will the Grand Council care if you don't get your job back?
There won't be any trouble. They couldn't replace me in stair treads, and they know it. Pass the Gorot, will you, Mother?
Here. But it's fattening, Zeno.
Well, I got a hard pass coming up, Mother. I owe it to myself.
And you will be careful, Zeno.
Oh, Mother, if I've told you once, I've told you a thousand times. It's just an invasion rocket from that stupid planet Earth. So will you stop worrying?
Ah, you're just like your father was, Zeno. Too brave for your own good.
I am? Well, it's nothing, really. I took my time going over to the field where the Earth rocket was to land. I got there at 10, with not another soul around. Another few minutes, and I had my pocket radar screen working. Yep, the rocket was coming in, right on time. Then I could hear it out in space, and soon after that I could see it, bearing our first visitors from Earth. Gee, I was thinking they must be a brave crew. I almost felt sorry for them. It wasn't a bad landing. Not the greatest, but not bad. After another 10 minutes, a port in the side of the rocket started to swing open, and I walked over. If I do say it myself, I made quite an impression.
Commander. Commander, look.
Great Scott, what is it?
Commander, I think we've met our first Martian.
All right, keep back, everybody. Dr. Fielding and I will deal with it. Him, whatever it is. Hand me the Martian kit, Parker.
All ready, sir.
Come on, Billy. We'll be ready for anything.
Right, Commander. Incredible. Absolutely incredible.
I'll try to talk to him.
We Earth people. We friends. Friends? We come from out there.
Blast that feeling. I feel like a fool.
Let me try, Commander. We bring you presents. Here, we bring you beads, cloths of many colors. Take them.
You wouldn't have something a little more conservative?
Fielding, he speaks Esperanto.
Incredible, incredible.
Gentlemen, welcome to Mars.
It's almost as if he was expecting us.
Oh, yes, for some days now. Ever since you left Earth, as a matter of fact.
You hear that, Fielding?
Commander, we may very well be in the presence of a superior race.
Well, thank you.
You say you expected us? Everyone expected us?
Oh, certainly.
But you're here alone.
Yes. Well, unfortunately, all other adult Martians are, shall we say, unavailable.
For how long?
Not wishing to pry, but how long are you staying?
Well, they've taken to the hills, have they? No need to be afraid of us. No need at all.
There's no one in your city over there?
Mainly unavailable. But I'll be glad to show you around. Martian hospitality, you know.
Amazing. Can we go right away, Commander? I'll get Connie.
You can call her, Fielding, but we don't want to blunder into a trap. All right, men. All in. Parker, take 3 men and stay here for rocket guard.
Yes, sir.
Ready, Fielding?
All set, Commander. Connie, I want you to meet our first Martian.
Dr. Fielding, I don't believe it.
Miss Morrison, this is 13756. Call Zeno. Miss Morrison, this is Zeno.
How do you do?
Well, how do you do?
Incredible. But he's almost handsome in a strange way. And he speaks our language.
Maybe a trick of some kind. Expedition force, on to...
It's a little difficult to pronounce.
On to the city!
We march into the city, which, of course, appeared quite deserted. Plan X. I show them a few of the sites, the canals, the Og factory, and the hall of the Grand Council. I was walking alongside of Connie, Miss Morrison, who was most unlike the women of Mars. I caught myself showing off, riding the aerial transmission belt with one hand. Finally, I took them all to the art museum.
Oh, Commander, this place, this civilization, it's fantastic, fantastic.
Look at this sculpture, Dr. Fielding, the line, the detail. I've never seen anything so beautiful.
It's nothing, really.
Zeno, you don't mean that you...
Well, no. You see, I work at an atomic escalator factory. I'm in stair treads.
Everybody, over here. Look at this.
Oh, what is it? Why, isn't that what...
Zeno, is this what I think it is?
Hmm? I'll have to read the nameplate. Oh, yes, a flying saucer from 1952, your calendar. 100 years old.
1952, the year of the flying saucers. Then they did come from Mars.
Oh, yes.
But none of them ever landed on Earth. Why?
It just didn't seem worthwhile. Nothing personal, of course.
I just can't get over this planet. It's so different from anything we imagined.
Now, here's something you might be interested in. Right over here.
What? Looks like a weapon of some kind.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, you see, it's a paralyzer ray. 300 years old.
But why do you have it in a museum?
You don't mean that weapons like this are 300 years obsolete?
Well, you might say that, yes. You see, no adult Martian has carried a weapon for hundreds of years.
Well, why not?
Why should we?
But to defend yourself.
Well, we just have no aggressive impulses, that's all.
Well, if someone struck you, wouldn't you strike back?
I couldn't. But it doesn't matter. No one could strike me.
No Martian, that is.
Yeah. We've never had any trouble.
Zeno, you're in the diplomatic service?
The escalator game.
Yet you were delegated to meet us.
Yes, by the Grand Council. You see, we stopped having diplomats handle our important missions years ago. Again, nothing personal, of course.
I see. But you are empowered to deal with us.
Deal with you? I certainly am.
Good. Now, it seems logical to me that we should work out a mutual defense pact. Not right now, of course.
Mr. Zeno! Mr. Zeno!
Who's that?
We look like children.
Yes, to see you, Mr. Zeno.
Just some little friends of mine.
Oh, they're darling.
What's the problem, Army?
We're building something, and we're all out of uranium. We need some right away, and...
Zeno, does he mean real uranium?
Oh, of course, Dr. Fielding. Oh, it won't hurt them a bit.
We have to have it right away, Mr. Zeno. We just have to have it.
The city was deserted. Where did these children come from?
Oh, you know how it is with kids when they get to playing.
You'll get the uranium for us, won't you, Mr. Zeno? Will you?
Fascinating. What are they playing, Zeno?
Yes. What's the game?
I don't think you've heard of it, Commander. It's called Plan X.
Autolite is bringing you Mr. Jack Benny in Plan X. Tonight's presentation in radio's outstanding theater of thrills, Suspense.
Say, Harlow, do you like to make speeches?
Sure, Hap, especially about the Autolite Stay Full battery. Friends, Romans, motorists, lend me your ears while I praise the greatest of the great, the incomparable Autolite Stay Full. The battery that needs water only three times a year in normal car use. The battery that gives longer life as proved by tests conducted according to accepted life cycle standards. The famous Autolite Stay Full has over three times the liquid reserve of ordinary batteries. And because every positive plate is protected by fiberglass retaining mats to reduce shedding and flaking, the Autolite Stay Full just naturally gives longer life than ordinary batteries.
And where can one get this glorious battery?
From your nearest Autolite battery dealer who services all makes of batteries. To quickly locate him, just phone Western Union and ask for Operator 25.
And I'll tell you where you can get an Autolite Stay Full, the battery that needs water only three times a year in normal car use.
And remember, from bumper to tail light, you're always right with Autolite.
And now, Autolite brings back to our Hollywood soundstage Mr. Jack Benny in Elliot Lewis's production of Plan X, a tale well calculated to keep you in suspense.
For the next week, I showed the Earth expedition around the city, signed a few treaties, and had several long conversations with Miss Morrison. Well, not too long, but I felt we were building a solid friendship. It was too bad it was coming to an end.
You're not going out again this evening, Zeno?
Mother, so I've been out two evenings in a row. Doesn't have to be fatal, you know.
This is the time of year you always get that chest cold.
Oh, chest cold, chest cold. Anyway, Mother, I have to go over to the rocket.
Don't they plan to go back to Earth tomorrow?
They plan to, yes. Miss Morrison promised to take a little farewell walk with me this evening.
Don't let her keep you out in the moonlight too long, Zeno.
Mother, why, that's the most ridiculous thing.
You just don't know how attractive you are.
Now, Mother, Miss Morrison and I are merely friends. And to think of anything beyond that is just...
Mr. Zeno! Mr. Zeno! We're almost finished the game, Mr. Zeno.
Good, good. All finished, Army?
Just about. It's tomorrow morning at 8:45, isn't it?
8:45. Anything else you need, Army? I mean, any more uranium?
No, I just wanted to make sure it was 8:45. Well, see you in the morning, Mr. Zeno. Bye, Mr. Zeno.
See you in the morning, Army.
Such a cute little fellow, Zeno. And smart.
Is he? Mother, you have no idea. The Earth expedition was camped beside their rocket, getting ready for takeoff the next day. Connie, Miss Morrison, waved when she saw me coming. I waved back, and then she smiled at me, and I smiled back. It was a beautiful evening. We walked out over the plain, Connie and I, and then we sat down quite close. Connie lit a cigarette, and I opened up a package of Gurkhog.
Zeno?
Yes, Connie. Miss Morrison.
Connie. How is it you're not married, Zeno? Don't Martians believe in it?
Oh, definitely. But there's Mother and...
And what?
Connie, you don't find me a little bit strange?
You mean because you're a Martian?
Not exactly. You see, even to Martian girls, I'm a little bit strange.
I find you very attractive, Zeno.
Really?
You're from a superior race?
Well...
The commander may not see it, but Dr. Fielding does, and I do. Your civilization, your culture, and you.
Actually, I'm...
What are the other Martians like? You know, I seem to feel there are people all around watching, waiting, and yet we've seen only you.
And the children, of course.
Yes, and the children. They've been playing around the rocket all day.
Yes, yes.
Zeno, what'll happen to this planet, this beautiful planet, when the next Earth rocket comes? And the next one?
Connie.
I'd almost like to stay here. Or I wish we'd never come. None of us.
Connie, there's something I...
What, Zeno? What is it?
It's just that... It's getting cold. Maybe we better go back. I walked with Connie back to the rocket, and then I went home. There was a message on the autophonopad. The Grand Council wanted to see me at once. You sent for me, gentlemen?
13756 called Zeno. You are nearing the completion of Plan X.
I hope my work has been satisfactory.
You were selected for certain qualifications, Zeno. Set habit patterns, attention to detail, no strong emotional drives.
I remember, yes.
You have assumed a responsibility based on those qualifications.
I suppose you might put it that way.
Are you still prepared to discharge that responsibility?
Well, I think you might as well know that it's been my criticism in the past, as well as that of a lot of other taxpayers, that the Grand Council interferes entirely too much in the private lives of, well, what I mean to say...
Are you prepared to discharge your responsibility?
But about Connie, I mean Miss Morrison, isn't there some way...
You know that there is not.
Well, I suppose not, no.
Plan X will then be completed.
I assure the Grand Council, at 8:45 tomorrow morning, Plan X will be completed. I didn't sleep well that night. Mother was worried when I hadn't any appetite in the morning. She thought it was the start of one of my chest colds. Purposely, I didn't go out to the rocket until almost 8:40. They were blasting the motors, getting ready to take off.
Zeno, I thought you weren't coming.
I overslept, Connie. That is, I didn't really oversleep, but...
The children have been here for an hour.
We're just about to finish playing, Mr. Zeno.
Oh, good, Army. Did you win the game? Plan X?
I think so. We'll know in a minute, Mr. Zeno.
They're so intense. Are the children on Mars always that way, Zeno?
Well, not always, no.
Ah, come to see us off, did you, Zeno? Good boy. We counted on you.
Well, thank you.
Come over here, Fielding.
Yes, Commander.
Connie, Fielding, Zeno here has been so helpful to us that I've come to a decision.
That's very nice of you, but I'm pretty well stocked up on beads right now.
Different kind of a present. Zeno, I've decided to invite you to come with us to Earth.
To Earth?
How about it, Zeno? We're taking off in 16 minutes at 9 o'clock. How about it?
Well, it's not that I don't appreciate your thinking of me, but Mother would worry and...
You see, we need you, Zeno.
That's not true.
Well, I'm afraid it is. You see, I think Zeno is a much more important man than a worker in an elevator factory.
Escalator. I'm in stair trance.
And if we have Zeno along the next time we come back to Mars, we'd be much less likely to run into, well, an ambush.
I'm afraid he's right, Connie.
He's not right.
How about it, Zeno?
Thanks, but no.
Commander, those kids, they've got some sort of a... ray gun set up.
Fielding. Is it real, Fielding?
Why, it looks like it, Commander.
Get Zeno over in front of us, quick. Now they can't shoot without hitting him. Get your gun out, Parker.
You mean the kids, Commander?
If we have to, yes. Tell them not to fire on us, Zeno.
I'm sorry, Connie. Really sorry.
Oh, it's all right, Zeno. Do what you have to do.
Shall we shoot, Mr. Zeno?
Have your gun ready, Parker.
It wouldn't do any good, Commander. All right, Army. Plan X.
Did you fire, Parker?
Me, sir? Fire a gun? Well, I couldn't. I couldn't do a thing like that.
No, of course you couldn't. I don't know what made me ask.
The rocket, its motors have stopped. Its motors have stopped, Commander.
Well, we aren't going anywhere, are we?
Someone said something about going back to Earth.
Back to Earth?
Oh, no. Of course not.
Everybody all right?
What happened, Commander? What happened?
Nothing, really. It's just that Army and his little friends built a maturity ray. It takes people who are, shall we say, less advanced and increases their IQ by several thousand years.
That's amazing.
Child's play.
Zeno, do you mean to say...
Commander, Dr. Fielding, Parker, Connie, permit me to congratulate you as fellow Martians.
Utterly amazing.
Connie.
Look, here come the Martians.
Our fellow Martians, thousands of them. They're coming to welcome us.
Connie.
Oh, look at them. Oh, they look so handsome, so intelligent, so...
Connie.
Yeah, excuse me, Zeno. I'll be back, Commander. I have to go to them. I'll be back.
Well, she did like me for a while before Plan X. But she did like me. Even just for a while. That's something, isn't it?
Suspense. Presented by Autolite. Tonight's star, Mr. Jack Benny. Suspense is transcribed and directed by Elliot Lewis, with music composed by Lucian Morowick and conducted by Lud Gluskin. Plan X was written for Suspense by Richard Powell. Featured in tonight's cast were Mary Jane Croft, Norma Varden, John McIntyre, Truda Marson, Howard McNear, William Conrad, Jack Crucian, Joseph Kearns, and Stumpy Singer.
The 1953 March of Dimes has nearly passed by. If you haven't given your dime or dollar to help in the crusade against polio, why not do it now? Send your contribution to your local March of Dimes headquarters.
This is the CBS Radio Network.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, we've made it. Well, made it to the last break anyway. But I can promise this really is the last break.
Up next is courtesy of the LibriVox Project and volunteer Michael Samples. It's the reading of the short story, Dagon, by Howard Phillips Lovecraft. If after hearing this recitation of this story, you'd like a copy of the short story itself, well, like I've been saying this entire show, there'll be a link in the show notes. I suppose I should say it one more time, although you're probably tired of hearing it. I'm getting a little tired of saying it. But the website is www.nighttransmissions.com. No space between the night and the transmissions. This is show 50. This story was originally published in the Vagrant magazine in 1919.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recording by Michael Sample, Halifax, Nova Scotia, Canada, 2008. Dagon by H.P. Lovecraft. I am writing this under an appreciable mental strain, since by tonight I shall be no more. Penniless and at the end of my supply of the drug which alone makes life endurable, I can bear the torture no longer, and shall cast myself from this garret window into the squalid street below. Do not think, from my slavery to morphine, that I am a weakling or a degenerate. When you have read these hastily scrawled pages, you may guess, though never fully realize, why it is that I must have forgetfulness or death. It was in one of the most open and least frequented parts of the broad Pacific that the packet of which I was to supercargo fell a victim to the German sea raider. The Great War was then at its very beginning, and the ocean forces of the Hun had not completely sunk to their later degradation, so that our vessel was made a legitimate prize, whilst we of her crew were treated with all the fairness and consideration due us as naval prisoners. So liberal, indeed, was the discipline of our captors that 5 days after we were taken, I managed to escape alone in a small boat with water and provisions for a good length of time. When I finally found myself adrift and free, I had but little idea of my surroundings. Never a competent navigator, I could only guess vaguely by the sun and stars that I was somewhat south of the equator. Of the longitude I knew nothing, and no island or coastline was in sight. The weather kept fair, and for uncounted days I drifted aimlessly beneath the scorching sun, waiting either for some passing ship or to be cast on the shores of some habitable land. But neither ship nor land appeared, and I began to despair in my solitude upon the heaving vastness of unbroken blue. The change happened whilst I slept. Its details I shall never know, for my slumber, though troubled and dream-infested, was continuous. When at last I awakened, it was to discover myself half-sucked into a slimy expanse of hellish black mire, which extended about me in monotonous undulations as far as I could see, and in which my boat lay grounded some distance away. Though one might well imagine that my first sensation would be of wonder at so prodigious and unexpected a transformation of scenery, I was in reality more horrified than astonished. For there was in the air and in the rotting soil a sinister quality which chilled me to the very core. The region was putrid with the carcasses of decaying fish and of other less describable things which I saw protruding from the nasty mud of the unending plain. Perhaps I should not hope to convey in mere words the unutterable hideousness that can dwell in absolute silence and barren immensity. There was nothing within hearing, and nothing in sight save a vast reach of black slime. Yet the very completeness of the stillness and the homogeneity of the landscape oppressed me with a nauseating fear. The sun was blazing down from a sky which seemed to me almost black in its cloudless cruelty, as though reflecting the inky marsh beneath my feet. As I crawled into the stranded boat, I realized that only one theory could explain my position. Through some unprecedented volcanic upheaval, a portion of the ocean floor must have been thrown to the surface, exposing regions which for innumerable millions of years had lain hidden under unfathomable watery depths. So great was the extent of the new land which had risen beneath me, that I could not detect the faintest noise of the surging ocean, strain my ears as I might, nor were there any sea fowl to prey upon the dead things. For several hours I sat thinking, or brooding, in the boat, which lay upon its side and afforded a slight shade as the sun moved across the heavens. As the day progressed, the ground lost some of its stickiness, and seemed likely to dry sufficiently for traveling purposes in a short time. That night I slept but little, and the next day I made for myself a pack containing food and water, preparatory to an overland journey in search of the vanished sea and possible rescue. On the third morning, I found the soil dry enough to walk upon with ease. The odor of the fish was maddening, but I was too much concerned with graver things to mind so slight an evil, and set out boldly for an unknown goal. All day I forged steadily westward, guided by a faraway hummock which rose higher than any other elevation on the rolling desert. That night I encamped, and on the following day still traveled toward the hummock, though that object seemed scarcely nearer than when I had first espied it. By the fourth evening I attained the base of the mound, which turned out to be much higher than it had appeared from a distance, an intervening valley setting it out in sharper relief from the general surface. Too weary to ascend, I slept in the shadow of the hill. I know not why my dreams were so wild that night, but ere the waning and fantastically gibbous moon that had risen far above the eastern plain, I was awake in a cold perspiration, determined to sleep no more. Such visions as I had experienced were too much for me to endure again, and in the glow of the moon I saw how unwise I had been to travel by day. Without the glare of the parching sun, my journey would have cost me less energy. Indeed, I now felt quite able to perform the ascent which had deterred me at sunset. Picking up my pack, I started for the crest of the eminence. I have said that the unbroken monotony of the rolling plain was a source of vague horror to me, but I think my horror was greater when I gained the summit of the mound and looked down the other side into an immeasurable pit or canyon, whose black recesses the moon had not yet soared high enough to illuminate. I felt myself on the edge of the world, peering over the rim into a fathomless chaos of eternal night. Through my terror ran curious reminiscence of Paradise Lost and Satan's hideous climb through the unfashioned realms of darkness. As the moon climbed higher in the sky, I began to see that the slopes of the valley were not so perpendicular as I had imagined. Ledges and outcroppings of rock afforded fairly easy footholds for a descent, whilst after a drop of a few hundred feet, the declivity became very gradual. urged on by an impulse which I cannot definitely analyze, I scrambled with some difficulty down the rocks and stood on a gentler slope beneath, gazing into the Stygian deeps where no light had yet penetrated. All at once, my attention was captured by a vast and singular object on the opposite slope, which rose steeply about 100 yards ahead of me, an object which gleamed whitely in the newly bestowed rays of the ascending moon. That it was merely a gigantic piece of stone, I soon assured myself, but I was conscious of a distant impression that its contour and position were not altogether the work of nature. A closer scrutiny filled me with sensations I cannot express, for despite its enormous magnitude and its position in an abyss which had yawned at the bottom of the seas since the world was young, I perceived beyond a doubt that the strange object was a well-shaped monolith, whose massive bulk had known the workmanship and perhaps the worship of living and thinking creatures. Dazed and frightened, yet not without a certain thrill of the scientist's or archaeologist's delight, I examined my surroundings more closely. The moon, now near the zenith, shone weirdly and vividly above the towering steeps that hemmed in the chasm, and revealed the fact that a far-flung body of water flowed at the bottom, winding out of sight in both directions and almost lapping my feet as I stood on the slope. Across the chasm, the wavelets washed the base of the Cyclopean monolith, on whose surface I could now trace both inscriptions and crude sculptures. The writing was in a system of hieroglyphics unknown to me, and unlike anything I had ever seen in books, consisting for the most part of conventionalized aquatic symbols such as fishes, eels, octopi, crustaceans, mollusks, whales, and the like. Several characters obviously represented marine things which are unknown to the modern world, but whose decomposing forms I had observed on the ocean-risen plain. It was the pictorial carving, however, that did most to hold me spellbound. Plainly visible across the intervening water, on account of their enormous size, was an array of bas-reliefs whose subject would have excited the envy of a Dore. I think that these things were supposed to depict men, at least a certain sort of men, though the creatures were shown disporting like fishes in the waters of some marine grotto, or paying homage at some monolithic shrine, which appeared to be under the waves as well. Of their faces and forms I dare not speak in detail, for the mere remembrance makes me grow faint. Grotesque beyond the imagination of a Poe or a Bulwer, they were damnably human in the general outline, despite webbed hands and feet, shockingly wide and flabby lips, glassy, bulging eyes, and other features less pleasant to recall. Curiously enough, they seemed to have been chiseled badly out of proportion with their scenic background, for one of the creatures was shown in the act of killing a whale, represented as but a little larger than himself. I remarked, as I say, their grotesqueness and strange size, but in a moment decided they were merely the imaginary gods of some primitive fishing or seafaring tribe, some tribe whose last descendant had perished eras before the first ancestor of the Piltdown or Neanderthal man was born. Awestruck at this unexpected glimpse into a past beyond the conception of the most daring anthropologist, I stood musing whilst the moon cast queer reflections on the silent channel before me. Then suddenly I saw it. With only a slight churning to mark its rise to the surface, the thing slid into view above the dark waters. Vast, polyphemus-like, and loathsome, it darted like a stupendous monster of nightmares to the monolith, about which it flung its gigantic scaly arms, the while it bowed its hideous head and gave vent to certain measured sounds. I think I went mad then. Of my frantic ascent of the slope and cliff and of my delirious journey back to the stranded boat, I remember little. I believe I sang a great deal and laughed oddly when I was unable to sing. I have indistinct recollections of a great storm sometime after I reached the boat. At any rate, I knew that I heard peals of thunder and other tones which nature utters only in her wildest moods. When I came out of the shadows, I was in a San Francisco hospital, brought thither by the captain of the American ship which had picked up my boat in mid-ocean. In my delirium I had said much, but found that my words had been given scant attention. Of any land upheaval in the Pacific, my rescuers knew nothing, nor did I deem it necessary to insist upon a thing which I knew they could not believe. Once I sought out a celebrated ethnologist, and amused him with peculiar questions regarding the ancient Philistine legend of Dagon, the fish god. But soon perceiving that he was hopelessly conventional, I did not press my inquiries. It is at night, especially when the moon is gibbous and waning, that I see the thing. I tried morphine, but the drug has given only transient surcease, and has drawn me into its clutches as a hopeless slave. So now I am to end it all, having written a full account for the information of the contemptuous amusement of my fellow men. Often I ask myself if it could not all have been pure phantasm, a mere freak of fever as I lay sun-stricken and raving in the open boat after my escape from the German man-of-war. This I ask myself, but ever does there come before me a hideously vivid vision in reply. I cannot think of the deep sea without shuddering at the nameless things that may at this very moment be crawling and floundering on its slimy bed, worshipping their ancient stone idols and carving their own detestable likenesses on submarine obelisks of water-soaked granite. I dream of a day when they may rise above the billows to drag down in their reeking talons the remnants of a puny war exhausted mankind, of a day when the land shall sink and the dark ocean floor shall ascend amidst universal pandemonium. The end is near. I hear a noise at the door, as of some immense slippery body lumbering against it. It shall not find me. God, that hand! The window! The window!
And with that, so ends the dramatic presentation portion of Night Transmissions. And so for the remaining few minutes together, I'm going to play a little bit of music. I hope to play here things you have either never heard or haven't heard in a long time.
Another weekend gone. Another Monday looking for a job. What's the odds on getting work of any kind? Finding a job, any kind of a job. Anything. Fed up to the teeth with doing nothing. Fed up with scrounging for a living. If you can call it a living. Lady, please give me a job. Mister, I'm willing to work, just try me. I'll sweep the streets, I'll do a bit of anything. Willing to turn me hand to anything, 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 anything. Anything. Are they deaf? The bastards didn't seem to hear me. Looking for a job. What's the odds of chanting a million? More like 1 in 3 million, that's if they're telling the truth. Cooking the books, more likely. Sick of being on the outside, in the street. Sick of being last in the queue. Sick of being looked through as if I'm not there. The original invisible man. lady, give me a job. For Christ's sake, mister, give me a job. Not just a scheme, it's a job that I need. Not just filling in time, filling up holes, playing with waste ends at chipboard. Sawdust won't fill up the holes in me days, in me life. Sawdust won't help me to live with me wife, with me kid, with myself. It's work that I need, and cash in the hand at the end of the week. Another 12 months gone. What's the use of looking for a job? What's that a show? Where did it go? And how? Frittered away on the box. The box is eating my life. Tired of the bickering rows. Ashamed of the things that I say. And tired of being ashamed. Disgusted with the smell of the scrap heap. And scared of the thoughts that come into me head. Jesus, I wish I was. Unless you're one of the walking dead, you don't know what it's like. And I don't need some teller-faced git to tell me to get on me bike. Lady, give me a job. Not next year, mister, but now give me a job. I'm at the end of me tether. Give me a job, but I'll get on me bike and tear your stinking world apart.
Tell me, my Führer, what can I do? My hands are freezing and my nose is blue. I'm dying of cold, but then you never can tell. 'Cause when the Russians come, they make it hotter than hell. I got a touch of pneumonia, I got a terrible cold. If I sneeze once more, it's bound to carry me off. When the Russians come, they always take us by storm. And there's nothing like running if you want to get warm. I want to go back to what's left of Berlin. Sick of a war that I ain't gonna win. I seen the big red star that scared the pants off the Tsar. Wanna go back to Berlin. Now listen, my Führer, I'm dead on my feet. I've got no place for sleeping. I've got nothing to eat. We've gone and finished all the food that we brought. And there's nothing here for miles around but food for thought. I've tied my belt, it damn near cuts me in two. I've slept on my feet till my boots wore through. When I get thirsty, I melt snow in my cup. Well, I may be going hungry, but I'm all fed up. I wanna go back to what's left of Berlin. Sick of a war that I ain't gonna win. I seen the big red star that scared the pants off the Tsar. Wanna go back to Berlin. Now tell me, my Führer, how in the hell can I be brave? I've got one foot in Russia, I've got one in the grave. I got snow in my rifle, I got lead in my pants. I'm so lonesome for a touch of romance. Well, I went to a village and I spotted a gal. I made a pass at her just to boost my morale. I got one broken ankle, I got two black eyes. Why couldn't she pick on somebody her size? I wanna go back to what's left of Berlin. Sick of a war that I ain't gonna win. I seen the big red star that scared the pants off the czar. Wanna go back to Berlin.
Easter time too, and your gravity fails and negativity don't pull you through. Don't put on any airs when you're down on Rue Morgue Avenue. They got some hungry women there and they really make a mess out of you. Now if you see St. Annie, please tell her thanks a lot. I cannot move, my fingers are all in a knot. Don't have the strength to get up and take another shot. And my best friend, my doctor, won't even say what it is I've got. Sweet Melinda, the peasants call her the goddess of gloom. She speaks good English and she invites you up into her room. And you're so kind and careful not to go to her too soon. And she takes your voice and leaves you howling at the moon. Up on Housing Project Hill, it's either fortune or fame. You must pick one or the other, though neither of them are to be what they claim. If you're looking to get silly, you better go back to from where you came. Because the cops don't need you, and man, they expect the same. Now all the authorities, they just stand around and boast how they blackmailed the sergeant at arms into leaving his post. Picking up Angel, who just arrived here from the coast, who looked so fine at first but left looking just like a ghost. Burgundy but soon hit the harder stuff. Everybody said they'd stand behind me when the game got rough. But the joke was on me, there was nobody even there to bluff. I'm going back to New York City, I do believe.